the summer. But when Toby saw that they'd broken up right around Valentine's Day, she was sure that her moment had arrived. She'd asked him to our junior prom and was thrilled when he accepted, even though he kept making it very clear that they were just going as friends. At the after party, when I'd been breaking up with my date, I hadn't loved prom. Toby and Wyatt had tipsily made out. Toby was sure this was proof of his feelings for her, despite all of us gently, and then not so gently, telling her that it was probably just the effect of Jägermeister and power ballads. Toby had tried to keep things going when he went back to boarding school, but Wyatt had reverted to treating Toby the way he treated all of us, totally platonically. "Oh my God, I think you're right," Toby said, squinting at the brightness of the screen in the darkness, her voice rising with every word. "Why hasn't he gotten in touch? Oh my God!" "Shh," I said, glancing around, not wanting to draw any more attention to us than we had to. Toby nodded, then looked back at her phone. "Oh my God," she said, in a whisper this time. "Okay," Palmer said, stopping in front of a white house that I was relieved to see looked like any other house on the block. No sign of a party unless you were really paying attention to what kind of music you could hear faintly coming from it. "Are we ready? Andy?" I nodded and reached into my purse, then handed over my bottle of Diet Coke, 3/4 full, to her. "Any preferences?" "Anything but brandy," I said, making a face. That did not mix well. Palmer nodded and led the way into the house. I knew Kevin enough to nod at in the halls, but I didn't think I'd ever actually had a conversation with him, so I was happy to let Palmer go first. I heard Bree and Toby laugh about something as I followed Palmer inside. I looked around and realized it was like pretty much every other party I'd been to. There were groups of people standing around talking or lounging on the couch, and the dining room table had been commandeered for what looked like a pretty major game of Beirut. The kitchen counter was covered with bottles and mixers and a half-filled blender, and through the open doors to the patio, I could see a keg. The people who always headed to the edges of people's yards to smoke were smoking, and I could already see two people standing in the shadows of the living room, talking close, only minutes away from starting to hook up. Palmer headed directly to the liquor bottles, and Toby and Bree headed outside to the keg as I scanned the room. I hadn't texted him that I was coming, but I had a feeling he might be here. From what I'd heard, he and his last girlfriend had ended things around when I'd dumped Zach, meaning we would both be unattached at the same time, which hadn't happened in a while. I was about to give up looking inside and see if he was by the keg when a girl I recognized from my AP Chem class stepped aside. And there he was, leaning against the kitchen counter, looking bored. Topher Fitzpatrick. My pulse kicked up, the way it always did when I saw him. I took him in for a moment longer, since I was sure he hadn't spotted me yet. There was a petite girl talking to him. I didn't recognize her, and she was laughing, smiling up at him while he gave her a smile she probably thought was genuine, and an invitation to keep talking. I knew better. But then, by this point, I probably knew him better than most people. He looked away for a second, scanning the room, and his eyes met mine. I held his gaze for just a second, but it was enough to know my evening had just taken a turn for the better. "Here," Palmer said as she appeared at my elbow with the Diet Coke bottle, the top firmly on. "It's rum. I mixed it up." "Thank you," I said, giving her a smile as I took the bottle. It was the only way I let myself drink at parties. If any pictures from the night got posted, the only thing I would be drinking, or even holding in my hand, was a Diet Coke. I knew only too well that all it would take was someone's cell phone picture on their profile, with a picture of me in the background, holding a beer, or even a glass with liquid in it that couldn't be identified, and suddenly it would be a story. I unscrewed the cap and took a long drink, feeling the kick of the rum. "Oh, look who's here," Palmer said flatly, her eyes straying to the kitchen. She sighed and looked at me. "Andy, I know." Topher was still talking to the petite girl as he drank from a Sprite bottle that I would bet money didn't just contain Sprite. After all, he was the one who'd taught me well. "What?" Toby asked as she joined us, sipping a beer that appeared to be mostly foam. Toby had never been great at tapping kegs. She followed Palmer's glance and then looked at me. "The gopher surfaces?" "Stop it," I said. "You know we don't approve," Palmer said in her best serious voice. I nodded. "Noted." I'd given up defending Topher to them years ago. He could be charming when he wanted to be. He just never seemed to want to be around my friends. "Speak for yourself," Toby said, taking another long drink. "I think it's romantic. Like Harry and Sally, circling around each other until they can admit how they feel." Palmer shook her head. "I really don't think that's what's happening here." "Well, what do you know?" Toby retorted. "I know you have foam on your nose," Palmer replied. "God damn it," Toby muttered as she wiped it off. "What's going on?" Bree asked, joining us, holding a cup of her own. She followed Toby's nod and then turned to me, shaking her head. "Andy?" "I heard it all from them already," I said, swirling the contents of my Diet Coke bottle for a second before taking a quick sip. "Hey," Toby said, flicking me on the arm. "Wing woman, you're falling down on the job." "Okay," I said, looking around the party, trying to find someone I hadn't dated, Toby hadn't already rejected, and wasn't someone we'd known since elementary school. "Just give me a second." "Alden!" I looked over as the party's host, Kevin Castillo himself, headed over to us from the dining room, holding up his hand for a high five, which Palmer returned with gusto. "Glad you could make it." Palmer nodded toward the table, where the game seemed to have broken up, at least for the moment. "How's it going?" "Getting killed in there," he said with a groan. "You guys want to help me out, Bree?" he asked Toby. "Or Toby?" he asked, turning to Bree. "Reverse those," I said, as I took another sip of my drink. Kevin frowned.
"Are you sure?"
He pointed at Bree again.
"It's not Toby?"
"I'm Toby," Toby said, starting to look annoyed. This was not all that infrequent, despite the fact that Bree was tall and willowy, where Toby was short and curvy, and Bree had long, straight, black hair, and Toby was a redhead who was always trying to flatten out her natural curls, with occasionally disastrous results. When you spend that much time together, you get mixed up, even if you don't look alike, or act anything alike for that matter. "We could combine our names," Bree said, turning to Toby and arching an eyebrow. "Toe-Bree. Then we could both answer to it."
"This has possibilities," Toby agreed.
"Then you could take history for me and get a great grade, and I could take calculus for you, and you wouldn't have to keep getting 38s on tests."
"Swap PE for calculus, and you've got a deal," Bree said.
"And then all the guys at parties would hit on me, too," Toby said, looking at Kevin Castillo, who turned red. Bree got embarrassed when you pointed it out, but she was undeniably gorgeous, and we'd gotten used to guys hitting on her.
"I like it.
It's a plan.
Done and done."
Kevin was looking back and forth between the two, like he was trying to catch up. After a second, he cleared his throat and tried again.
So,
he said, still looking at Bree.
Want to play, Bree?
Toe Bree, Toby said, shaking her head as Bree started to laugh. Weren't you paying attention?
Alden,
Kevin said, clearly baffled and giving up as he turned to Palmer.
I need your skills.
Palmer grinned as she looked at all the cups lined up. Growing up with four older siblings, two of them boys, meant Palmer was great at this kind of stuff. She'd been the one who taught us how to tap a keg, pack a bowl, and play quarters, Beirut, and beer pong. She could change a tire and throw a punch, and had learned how to drive when she was something like 14. Sure, she said with a shrug. Why not? She headed toward the dining room with Toby and Bree following, turning back to glance at me when it was clear I wasn't joining them. Andy? Not right now, I said, with what I hoped was a casual shrug. Maybe later. Palmer raised an eyebrow at me, and I knew she knew exactly why I wasn't joining her. Sure, she said, giving me a look that said she still didn't approve but wasn't going to say anything else. I had a feeling that if I hadn't just had the day that I had, Palmer would be giving me a much harder time right about now. Well, have fun. Make good choices, Toby called, in a louder voice than necessary as I took a step toward the kitchen, pretending I didn't know them. I had expected Topher would still be there, but the kitchen was empty. I thought for a second about going to look for him, but then decided against it and pushed myself up to sit on the counter. I grabbed a handful of Doritos from an open family-size bag and pulled out my phone. I'd find Topher eventually, or he'd find me, and it seemed like the easiest way to let him do that was to stay in one place. I hadn't expected to see a new text on my phone, since most of the people I regularly texted were all here, but there were three, all from Peter. Peter Wright.
In case any reporters get in touch, you need to say no comment about anything. Don't go on record. How's your dad holding up?
I blinked at the last one. This was the kind of information that Peter knew, not me. Why would he expect me to know that? Me. Not sure. I'm not home. I knew from experience what his response to this would be, so I started typing fast. Me. Just out getting a snack with my girlfriends. If you want to know how he's doing, ask him. I looked down at the phone for a moment longer, waiting to see if he was going to respond. It made sense that Peter was concerned about my dad. It was his job to be concerned. But if he wanted to know anything about my dad's mental or emotional state, I was the last person he should be talking to. Hey there. I looked up and saw that Topher was across from me, leaning against the kitchen island. I wondered how long he'd been there. Toby had once helpfully informed me that I had a super weird reading face. Hey, I said, locking my screen and setting my phone down, matching the blaséness of his tone. We'd established our boundaries 3 years ago when this had started, and we'd never had a problem sticking to them. We kept it casual, which let us be in each other's lives without things getting tense or strained. Which I appreciated, since he was the only person who truly understood what my life was like. His mom was in the Senate, and over the last 3 years, she and my dad had given the media one of their favorite narratives, the senator and the congressman, on opposite sides of the aisle but living in neighboring towns, against all odds and Washington politics, forging a friendship. They often rode together on the train back and forth to D.C., and despite the media's tendency to spin, I knew my dad genuinely liked Claire Fitzpatrick. When both she and my dad were home at the same time, which wasn't often, she and her husband would come to dinner, or we'd go to their house, and Topher and I almost always found a moment to escape, usually around the time when the subsidies talk started.
"What's up?" I asked as I took a sip of my drink, not letting myself break eye contact with him.
Topher, short for Christopher, was handsome in a way I had never gotten used to, not even after 3 years. It was the kind of handsome, tall, tan, blonde, gray-eyed, that you saw in ads for expensive watches and luxury sweaters. There was a kind of polish and control to him that I had recognized immediately.
"Not much," he said, taking a drink from his Sprite bottle, then setting it down and looking at me, his voice getting a little softer.
"How are you holding up?"
I shrugged one shoulder. "I'm fine," I said. His expression didn't change much, but I could tell he didn't believe me.
"Really?" I said firmly. "I'm leaving town for the summer at the end of the week anyway, so it's not like I'll be here dealing with it."
"Oh, yeah," Topher said, nodding. "That pre-med thing, right?"
I nodded, knowing better than to attach any meaning to the fact that Topher had remembered this. After all, it was what we'd both been taught to do. Hang on to dates and details, remember that colleague's daughter's name and where she's going to college, make sure you know that important donor loves orchids, and if you bring them up, she'll be beyond pleased and talk to you about them all night. Collect these facts about these people you don't really know, and let them think you do.
You got it.
So, this will probably be the last time we see each other for a while,
he said, his voice dropping slightly lower.
Maybe so, I said, not letting myself look away, starting to smile.
Topher arched an eyebrow at me, and I saw a smile tugging at the corner of his mouth. He pushed himself off the island and crossed to me. He leaned over, casually, every move just so, like he was in no hurry. His lips were right near my ear, but he didn't speak at first, just let out a breath against my skin that made me shiver.
"In that case," he finally said, speaking low, even though we were the only ones in the kitchen.
He took a lock of my hair and curled it around his finger before he let it drop.
"Want to get out of here?"
Topher went first. He seemed to have a sixth sense for when empty rooms were available at parties, and I had an amazing ability to walk into just the wrong room at just the wrong time. He'd told me to meet him in the basement, and now I needed to wait long enough that nobody would see us disappearing together. Topher had established his ground rules early on. We couldn't tell anyone. I'd decided my friends were an exception to this, since I trusted them completely. And we'd do whatever we could to make sure nobody would find out. I'd established some of my own. Nothing but kissing, and everything we did or talked about stayed between us. I also found that I could be honest with him in a way I never was with my other boyfriends. I knew that whatever I told him, he would keep to himself. Our situation was what I'd once heard Peter describe as mutually assured destruction. We knew too much about each other, and we both had too much to lose for either one of us to say anything. When we both started dating people, these ground rules grew to include that we never did anything when either of us was with someone, which meant we could go months without seeing each other. But it had become something that I'd gotten pretty reliant on. I looked down at my phone again and realized that it was now safe for me to join him. I crossed through the living room and headed toward the basement, making sure to lock the door behind me. Sometimes, making out with Topher was like quenching a thirst, and sometimes it just made me thirstier. Thankfully, tonight it was the first one. After we'd been kissing for a while, the intensity faded, and our eyes grew slower and more lingering. I broke away and rested my head on his chest, and he smoothed my hair down absently with one hand. I looked up from the couch where we were lying. This seemed to be more like a converted garage than a basement, with the couch and TV jockeying for space with workbenches and tools. Someone in Kevin Castillo's family was clearly really into cars. There were three in the basement garage and two more covered with tarps, tools stacked neatly next to them. I looked at the one nearest to us, a red vintage Mustang, and felt a sharp pang, the way I always did when I saw one. My mother's had been yellow, a 65 convertible that had been her pride and joy. But I hadn't seen it in years. I assumed that it had gone wherever all her things had gone, either sold or to storage somewhere. All I did know was that when I moved into the new house, there was no trace of my mother in it. I turned my back on the Mustang and ran my hand over the fabric of the couch. "This was surprisingly comfortable," I said, and heard Topher give a short laugh. "Well, it's no laundry room." I pushed myself up slightly to look at him, and he smiled as he pulled a lock of my hair forward, winding it around his finger. "I was thinking about that night a few days ago, actually."
"Were you?"
"Yeah," he said, nodding.
"Just about how lucky we were."
This made me sit up a little straighter, and I looked him in the eye, starting to get nervous, worried that he was suddenly changing the rules on me.
"Lucky because we didn't get caught," he clarified,
and I felt myself relax.
"We really were."
It was 3 years ago, but I could remember so clearly what it had been like. The thrill of my first real party, then the flashing lights streaking in through the window, and my utter panic when I realized that not only was I in trouble, but I might have wrecked my father's career. I was desperately searching for an exit in the chaos, and then, out of nowhere, was Topher Fitzpatrick, taking my hand in his. I didn't know him. We went to different schools, and I'd said only about 5 words to him the year before, at an event at the governor's mansion. But I saw in his eyes the exact same thing I was feeling, the paralyzing fear that comes with knowing just how high the stakes really are. He leaned closer to me to be heard above the noise of people running, panicking, bottles and glasses breaking as everyone tried to get out. And fast.
"Want to get out of here?"
he'd asked. I nodded, and he held my hand tighter as we ran through the house. He stopped in front of a door that I would have run past and pushed it open. It was a laundry room, a tiny space with a folding table, a stacked washer and dryer, and barely enough room to turn around. Topher pulled me inside, and we shut the door behind us and stood in the dark and waited. We weren't discovered right away, and after a few minutes of both of us panicking that cops were about to fling open the door at any moment, we both relaxed a little and found our way to the folding table. We sat side by side next to a stack of fluffy, neatly folded towels, moonlight streaming through the tiny window above the dryer, and the smell of fabric softener all around us. And when the panic that I was about to ruin everything had started to subside, I let myself appreciate this situation for the first time, that I was sitting very close to a cute, gray-eyed boy in the moonlight. We started talking about school, about our parents, about the counterspin we'd have ready in case we were discovered, that when we realized there was underage drinking happening, we'd removed ourselves from the situation immediately. Until I realized that enough time had passed that we could probably go out safely. I turned to Topher to tell him this and saw that he was sitting closer to me than I'd realized, and was looking at me thoughtfully, like he was studying my face. My heart started pounding hard, but I made myself keep looking into his eyes as he brushed a stray lock of hair from my forehead, and then wound it around his finger once before tucking it behind my ear. And then, moving so slowly, he leaned over and gave me my very first kiss. We'd ended up making out against the stack of towels until the party's host, sounding very annoyed, started banging on all the doors in the hallway, telling people that the party was over and to either help him clean up or get the hell out.
"So," Topher said, as I pushed myself off the table and tried to smooth my hair down.
My lips felt puffy, and I had a giddy, racing energy coursing through me. I'd just been kissed. I couldn't wait to tell my friends. I wondered if I looked any different. I turned to him and saw he looked slightly nervous, like he was bracing himself for something.
This doesn't have to mean anything, you know?
I blinked, realizing that he was scared I would want to turn this into something, like I would expect him to be my boyfriend or something now.
No, I said immediately. Of course not.
I'd never had a real boyfriend, but I'd been watching Palmer and Tom for a month now, and even the idea of that kind of dependency on someone made me feel claustrophobic. It was fun, though. Something washed over Topher's face when I said that, like he'd just seen something that he recognized. Relief mixed with the happiness of an unexpected discovery.
It was, he said, giving me a smile. So much better than being arrested.
And now, 3 years later, here we still were. I played with the buttons on his shirt, thinking about it. I kind of think maybe we should have refolded the towels. Topher laughed.
You know, I think it warped me. For months, I couldn't smell fabric softener without getting flashbacks.
So, what are you doing this summer? I asked, when I realized I didn't know, and after the silence between us was starting to stretch on.
Interning, he said with a long sigh. At my dad's office. Fun times.
Oh, I said, a little surprised. Topher's dad was a litigator, and while there was nothing wrong with doing an internship with your parent, we both knew it wasn't the best thing for your resume.
I know,
he said as he ran his hands over my shoulders, smoothing down the fabric of my sleeves.
But I was too late for the good stuff. I didn't start applying until last month. And by then, everything was gone. Internships, summer programs, even the volunteering slots had giant wait lists.
He leaned away slightly, like he was trying to get a better look at me.
You took care of this back in March, didn't you?
I gave him a tiny shrug. February, I said, holding back what I really wanted to say, which was that Topher should have known better. You had to get this stuff locked down early. The good jobs and internships and summer programs, the ones that looked impressive on your applications, the ones that mattered, they went fast. But I'm sure your dad's office will be good, I said, looking up at him, feeling beyond grateful once again that I was heading to Johns Hopkins, and that this summer would be the furthest thing from a questionable gap on my resume.
I'll let you know,
he said, tracing the outline of my lips with his thumb for a moment. Oh, yeah? I asked, propping myself up on my elbow. Are you going to write me a postcard or something? Topher smiled at this.
Every day, he said, matching my tone.
I laughed at that and pushed myself off the couch. I left first this time, returning to the party and hoping that nobody could tell anything had happened, that I didn't look different at all. 3 hours later, I yawned as I headed up the driveway to my house, Palmer waving to me out the window of the minivan. Bree had asked me if I wanted to sleep over at her place. Toby was, of course. But I'd said no, mostly because Bree's evil, ancient cat, Miss Cupcakes, seemed to have some kind of feline vendetta against me. I let myself in and walked across the foyer, turning off lights while running through my checklist in my head. I'd get ready for bed, go over my packing list for young scholars one more time, then I heard a creak of the floorboards behind me and whirled around, my heart hammering. There was nobody right behind me, but in the long hallway that led down to my dad's study, I saw my father standing in the study's doorway, peering out at me.
Andy?
I let out a shaky breath and took a step closer to him, squinting in the darkness. The only light was coming from the room behind him, stretching out a long, thin line across the floor. Hi, I called, holding one hand up in an awkward wave and then immediately dropping it again. Now, in hindsight, it seemed ridiculous that I was startled to hear someone else in the house, but I'd honestly forgotten he was here. My dad took another step toward me, then stopped, both of us pretty much staying at our ends of the hallway. He ran his hand over the back of his neck, blinking at me like he was surprised to see me, too.
I hadn't realized that you...
He cleared his throat, then started again.
I guess I thought...
But this sentence trailed off, too, and he pushed his shirt sleeve back to look at his watch.
It's late, isn't it?
I don't know, I said, stopping myself before pointing out that he was the one with the watch.
It's after 2,
he said, and I nodded, realizing that sounded about right. What were you doing up? I asked, even though this really wasn't that unusual. When my dad was home, he worked late most nights, and the weekends that I took the train to D.C. to stay in the apartment he kept in DuPont Circle, visits that were always accompanied by carefully crafted social media messages about how I was going to see my dad. I sometimes didn't even see him. He was in his office or at meetings the whole time.
I had to put some things in order,
he said, closing his eyes for a moment and rubbing the bridge of his nose.
There's a lot I'm leaving half done, and I want to make sure that it's taken care of.
I nodded and took a step back toward the staircase. So, I started, as my dad crossed his arms over his chest.
Is this when you normally come in?
He asked, sounding more confused than anything else.
Joy was okay with it?
I bit my lip hard to make sure I wouldn't laugh. I'd never really had a curfew to speak of. Ever since I was 12, there had been a revolving crew of vaguely related people who'd come to stay and help out with me. There had been an actual nanny hired when I'd first come back from Camp Stepping Stone, the summer-long grief camp my dad had sent me to right after the funeral. But when his opponent during that election found out about it, he started using it in his speeches as a way to trash my dad, saying that he would never hire outsiders to take care of his children. So, the nanny had been let go, and I'd had the first of many distant relatives come to stay. This had ended the controversy, thanks to Peter's spin. My dad was just bringing in family to help out during a difficult time. It was pretty hard to demonize that, the grieving widower doing the best he could, even though his opponent kept trying, which probably contributed to my dad's keeping his seat that fall. They never stayed all that long, these second cousins and step-siblings' children. They moved into the house or the furnished apartment above the garage, drove me around, and for the most part, let me do my own thing. Once I was able to drive myself, the job had pretty much become symbolic. There, in case someone questioned whether the congressman's daughter was living unsupervised by herself while he was in D.C. The most recent person had been Joy, my dad's stepsister's stepdaughter. But as soon as the scandal had exploded and my dad had moved back, she'd moved out, leaving a note on the kitchen counter telling my dad where to send her last check. But the high turnover of relatives meant I could tell them whatever I needed to when they moved in, and one of the first things I'd told Joy was that I had no curfew. "Yeah," I said now, taking another step toward the staircase. She was fine with it.
"Ah," my dad said, nodding.
"Oh," I said, remembering and turning back before I headed up the stairs. We were at opposite ends of the hallway now, and I couldn't make out his expression clearly anymore. "Peter texted. He wanted to know how you were doing." My dad looked at me for a moment, then sighed, his shoulders slumping slightly.
"I'm fine,"
he said, even though I could hear the exhaustion in his voice. "Well, you should probably tell Peter that. He seemed worried." My dad and I just stood there until the silence between us started to feel suffocating. "Night," I said, turning away and not letting myself look back, not even waiting to hear if he said it back to me. Then I hit the last light switch, throwing the foyer into darkness, and took the steps up to my room two at a time. Chapter 3. My phone rang the next morning at 7 a.m. I rolled over and reached for it, squinting at the screen. I didn't recognize the number, but it was a Baltimore area code. I answered immediately. "Hello?" I asked, hating that it probably sounded like I just woke up. "Good morning," a woman's voice on the other end said. "This is Caroline from the Young Scholars Program at Johns Hopkins. May I speak to Alexandra Walker?" "Speaking," I said. I held the phone away from me for a moment and cleared my throat hurriedly, making myself sit up straight. Just hearing the words "Young Scholars" was enough for me to start feeling some giddy butterflies in my stomach. Maybe she was calling to give me a last-minute reminder, or an official day-before welcome. "Oh." She cleared her throat, and I could hear some papers rustling on her end. "I'm sorry to call so early." "I was awake," I assured her, hoping that my voice wasn't contradicting this as I spoke. "And I'm incredibly excited to start the program tomorrow." There was a pause, and I heard the papers rustling again. "Yes," she said, and then I heard her take an audible breath, the kind you take before something painful is about to happen. "About that. I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to withdraw your acceptance to our program this year." I froze and felt myself blink twice. "Excuse me?" I asked, turning the volume up on my phone and pressing it harder against my ear, figuring I must just have misheard her. "Yes, I'm afraid." On the other end, the papers rustled again, and my heart started to beat very fast, like I'd just downed my daily latte in one gulp. "It looks like Dr. Rizzoli has withdrawn his letter of recommendation. And since we did not have another on file for you, your place went to one of the students on our waiting list." "What?" I whispered, my hand gripping the phone so tightly my knuckles were turning white. "I don't understand. I mean, this must be... There has to be something else I can do." "I'm afraid there isn't. Your spot has already been reassigned. And I'm sorry for the late notice, but Dr. Rizzoli didn't send us the email until last night," she said. I could hear the relief in her voice, like she'd gotten the hard part over with. She could see the finish line and just wanted to be off this call with me. "Your deposit and your tuition will, of course, be refunded." "Wait," I said, not even having anything to follow this, but somehow needing to keep her on the phone, to try to figure out some way around this. Because this couldn't really be happening. It couldn't. "Again, our apologies," she said, and I could tell how much she wanted to wrap this up.
You will be more than welcome to apply for next year's program, of course.
But, I said, willing myself to think faster.
I have a nice day.
A second later, the call was disconnected, and I was staring down at my phone. The whole conversation, completely wrecking my summer plans and possibly jeopardizing my future as a doctor, had taken 2 minutes and 33 seconds. My heart was still beating hard, and I had a desperate, panicky feeling flooding through my body. I needed to do something. I needed to fix this. Somehow I had to make this okay again. These things had to be reversible. This couldn't be over. I looked across my room, the early morning light slanting through my blinds, and saw my suitcase, the one that I'd packed last night, after having practically memorized the "what to bring" section of my informational documents. Somehow, seeing it there was enough to steel my resolve. I had packed. I had made plans and built my whole summer around this. Some woman named Caroline was not going to stop all of that with a 2-minute phone call. I pulled up my contacts and scrolled through them. I didn't have a number for Dr. Rizzoli, only an address from where I'd sent him his thank you note. This whole thing had to be because of yesterday's press conference. There was no other explanation for why he would suddenly be trying to distance himself from anything to do with my father. In this case, me. But if he'd sent an email undoing this, he could send another one putting things back into place. There was still some time, after all. The program didn't start until tomorrow. This could all still be okay. I just had to convince him that this had nothing to do with my dad, and that he needed to contact the program and tell them the email had been a mistake, sent accidentally from the drafts folder, in an Ambien haze, whatever. I didn't care what he told Johns Hopkins, but he had to reverse this. He had to. And I had a feeling he'd have a lot harder time telling me he couldn't if I was standing in front of him. I pushed myself out of bed and ran toward my closet. 20 minutes later, I sat in my car, across the street from the house of Dr. Daniel Rizzoli. He lived on Sound Beach, over by the water. The closer you got to the water, the nicer the houses got. Gorgeous and huge and intimidatingly fancy. And Dr. Rizzoli's was no exception. The last time I'd been there, it had been for a fundraiser for my dad. The house's gates had been flung wide. There had been candles and lanterns lining the driveway, and valets in white coats running around parking cars. My phone buzzed in the cup holder, and I looked down at it. It was a text from Palmer. She and Tom were going for breakfast at the diner in case anyone wanted to join them. I didn't know why they were up this early, but I also didn't want to get distracted by a text exchange. I had to focus. I put my phone face down on the passenger seat, then flipped open the visor mirror of my car and gave myself a last look. I'd wanted to look like I was competent and deserving of a recommendation, but not too dressed up, considering it wasn't even 8 yet. I'd gone with dark jeans and a button-down, and since I didn't want to waste time doing something with my hair, I'd pulled it into a knot on top of my head. I slicked on a tiny bit more lip gloss, then dropped it in my bag and flipped the visor up. "Okay," I said, taking in a breath, holding it for 7 seconds, then letting it out for 10. It was actually the only thing I'd taken away from Camp Stepping Stone, a way of making your heart rate slow and calming yourself down. I used it whenever I was preparing to do something stressful. But while this was not the most pleasant thing I could imagine doing today, at least I was prepared. I'd turned the radio off and practiced my speech the whole way over. I had answers lined up for all the arguments I could imagine Dr. Rizzoli making. I could do this. I took a breath, opened the door, and stepped out into the sunshine. "Hello, Dr. Rizzoli," I murmured under my breath, practicing. "Good morning, Dr. Rizzoli. Sorry to bother you," I nodded. That was the one. I straightened my shoulders and headed for the house. I was halfway across the street when I heard the dog. There was the sound of loud, joyful barking, and I turned around and felt my eyes widen. A large, white, fluffy dog was galloping down the road, tongue flying sideways out of its mouth, limbs landing in a haphazard pattern that seemed to send it listing to the side and then scrambling for balance every few steps. There was a leash dragging on the ground behind it, the plastic handle scraping along the asphalt with a dull hiss, occasionally bumping over rocks, but the dog was alone. There was no indication that there had been a human on the other end at some point. I looked around, starting to get concerned as the dog zigzagged back and forth across the road. This wasn't a busy street, but I still didn't think it was a good idea for this dog to be running loose. "Here, you?" I called, gesturing toward myself and feeling incredibly self-conscious about it. "Come here." The dog stopped and looked at me, then sat down right in the middle of the street, which I didn't think was an improvement. "Come on," I said again, gesturing to myself again as I took a small step closer to it. The dog leaped up and ran a few steps away, then sat down again, and I could see his long tail thumping on the ground. Clearly, he thought we were playing a game, and he seemed thrilled about it. "Okay, just stay," I said as I started to move toward him slowly. I was only a few feet away from the leash that was lying on the ground. If I could get a hold of it, I could at least try to figure out what should happen next. I had very little experience with dogs. We'd never had one when I was growing up, and none of my friends had dogs either. Palmer's family had cats that were semi-feral and came and went as they pleased. And Bree had Miss Cupcake's evil feline. Nathan Trenton, who I'd dated sophomore year, had a really awesome mutt that I'd loved. Nathan used to complain that I was more excited to see his dog than to see him. And when I'd realized that was true, I'd broken up with him. I moved carefully toward the dog, whose tail was still thumping on the ground. It was looking right at me, mouth open and tongue hanging out, and I could have sworn that it was smiling at me. I reached out slowly, keeping eye contact as I inched my way closer.
"Birdie!"
This was yelled out in a loud, panicky voice, and I turned around to see a guy running up the street, looking around frantically. When he saw the dog, I could see his shoulders slump with relief, even from a distance. He started running faster, and I turned back to the dog, which was when I noticed two things at almost exactly the same time. One, the dog was getting ready to run again, apparently convinced that his favorite game had taken on a new and exciting layer. And two, there was a car heading down the street toward us, going much faster than it should have been. I moved without even realizing I was going to. Going on instinct and panic, I ran toward the dog and grabbed its leash in my hand, then pulled him across the road. I felt the dog resist at first. But then it must have thought this was a fun idea because it started running, first next to me, then past me, pulling me off my feet. I hit the ground just as I heard a screech of brakes and a guy yelling, "Hey!" I saw the car swerve, then head off down the street again, still going too fast. The dog started covering my face in slobbery kisses, and I pushed it off as I sat up, still holding on to the leash in case he, because I could see now that it was a he, made another run for it. He was big. He had to be at least 100 pounds, maybe more, with fluffy white hair and a nose that was probably black at one point but was now mostly pink. He had a tail that curled up over his back, black eyes, and stubby white eyelashes. He had not stopped moving for a moment, jumping to his feet, then sitting down and trying to kiss me again, like he was thrilled with the way everything had turned out, his smile still in place. "Calm down," I said as I released my grip on the leash slightly. I wiped the dirt and gravel off on my jeans, then reached out and patted the dog's head, even though he probably didn't deserve it. His tail started thumping on the ground more rapidly, and he tilted his head to the side, like he was showing me that I should really be petting him by his ears.
"Birdie!"
The guy who had yelled before was running up to us, sounding half out of breath.
"I'm so sorry. Are you okay? Is he?"
He stopped and bent halfway over, his hands on his knees, taking deep breaths. "I'm fine," I said as I pushed myself up to standing. I was okay. Like, I might have a bruise on my hip tomorrow, but otherwise fine. The dog looked up at me with his head cocked to the side, and I had to admit he was pretty cute. For a moment, I felt sorry that he had been saddled with such a stupid name. I mean, Birdie? For a dog? I brushed off my hands and then rubbed the dog's ears once more. His hair was soft and silky, and there was so much of it. Like, if this dog got wet, he'd only be about half this size. I noticed a tag hanging from his green leather collar, a round gold disc with Bertie in engraved capitals. So that at least made a little more sense than Birdie, but not by much. "Here," I said, holding out the leash to the guy, who was still trying to get his breath back. I wasn't going to be rude. That had been drilled out of me years ago, first by my parents and then by Peter. But that didn't mean I needed to be overly polite to a guy who couldn't even keep hold of his pet. Also, I had something to do. The guy straightened up and smiled at me.
"Thanks," he said.
I took an involuntary step backward. For some reason, seeing him from a distance, I'd assumed he was older than me, in his 20s, maybe. But this guy looked around my age. He was only an inch or two taller than me, which meant he was probably around 5'10", and thin but with broad shoulders. He had dark brown hair that was cut short and neatly combed, and dark brown eyes. He was wearing a black shirt that read, "The Droid You're Looking For," in yellow capital letters, which rang a vague bell but nothing I could place. I could see that he had two deep dimples, like parentheses around his smile. They were incredibly distracting, and I made myself look away immediately. He was wearing glasses with frames that were straighter on top and then became rounded, and his smile widened when I met his eyes.
"Sure,"
I said as I took another step back.
I really am sorry," he said, looking down at the dog.
It seemed like he'd gotten his breath back now.
"I'm not sure what happened, but the leash got away from me."
He shrugged and went to put his hands in his pockets. And it wasn't until Birdie's head got yanked up that he seemed to remember he had a leash in one of them. I saw that his cheeks and the tips of his ears were starting to turn red. He cleared his throat, his voice getting softer with every word.
"I'm not great with dogs."
I was about to say something to this, like, what kind of excuse was that? He clearly owned a dog. When I decided to let it go. It's fine, I said, giving him a quick smile before I turned back to Dr. Rizzoli's house. I had taken a few steps toward it when I realized that all the dog drama had taken place in pretty clear view of the front windows. Had Dr. Rizzoli seen what had happened? The dog lunged toward me, and I heard the guy say, "Bert!" as he pulled him back, and then the soft sound of disappointed dog whimpering. But I was only half paying attention to this. My eyes were scanning the front of Dr. Rizzoli's house, my hopes starting to nosedive. All the curtains were drawn. There were no lights on that I could see, no cars in the driveway, and, most telling of all, there was a layer of green summer leaves covering the front steps. Either Dr. Rizzoli was out of town, or he hadn't left the house in a while. Why had I just assumed that he would be here, waiting for me, willing to correct the mistake and let me go to my program after all? I stared at the house, telling myself that I could still do this, that this wasn't over yet. I could get his number and call him and get him to change his mind. But even as I was forming this plan, I knew it wasn't going to work. All the adrenaline and righteous anger that had gotten me here was fading, and I was left with the reality of the situation. Dr. Rizzoli had emailed Johns Hopkins and gotten me pulled from the program. He'd meant to do that, and he wasn't about to undo it because I asked him nicely. Feeling like I was about to cry, something I very rarely did, usually only at movies, I turned around and started walking across the street, back to my car, crossing my arms over my chest.
So see you around?
The guy called after me, and I could hear the nervous, hopeful note in his voice. Unlike other circumstances, I probably would have responded to this. He was really cute, after all, even if he had no idea how to walk a dog. But not today. Not with everything that had been my life currently in pieces at my feet. "Probably not," I said, keeping my eyes fixed straight ahead as I pulled open my car door. "I don't live around here." I got in and shut the door but didn't start the car yet. Mostly because I had no idea what I was going to do now, or where I was going to go. The guy turned and started walking back the way he'd come, and I looked for maybe a moment longer than I should have, watching as Birdie took off at a run, the guy stumbling a few steps behind, trying to catch up. I made myself turn away, then picked up my phone. I unlocked it, then stopped. If I let myself think about the bigger picture, like what this actually meant for my future, I knew I would start to spiral out. I needed to think about my next immediate steps, small pieces that I could manage. I looked down at my phone and saw the text from Palmer was still open, and Bree had responded, saying she'd be at the diner if she could haul Toby out of bed. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew I wasn't going to figure it out without coffee. "Me. I'll be there too. See you in 15. Then I let out a long breath and started the car. I glanced back once to see if the guy and his dog were still there, but there was only an empty road behind me. We had always called it the diner, though according to the menus, it actually had a name, Glory Days Diner. I had never heard anyone call it that, though it did explain the high percentage of Bruce Springsteen songs on the mini jukeboxes that sat on the tables in the booths. We'd been going there since 8th grade, and we'd especially spent a lot of time there before we were invited to any parties, when we all wanted to be out of the house on weekend nights but didn't actually have anywhere to go. Now we had the booth we always sat in, and knew the waitresses who tolerated us, and the waitresses who flat-out hated us, and who the nice managers and busboys were. It was the place we always defaulted to, and where we sometimes went to the parking lot to have either screaming fights or